Vess and Dori, thank you so much for joining me today. We're going to be talking about your lovely anthology, A Study in Sherlock. Last year, I remember speaking to you about your anthology of critical essays around the canon. What propelled you to move from that into this area of original fiction?
Well, I think that the grand game, the collection of essays, was for a, shall we say, select audience.
The idea for this anthology actually arose, I take full blame for it. About 3 years ago now, I was asked to put together a panel on Sherlock Holmes for a crime conference, a crime writers conference. And I've done more than one of those, and I looked down the list of who was going to be present at the conference, and I said to the organizers, well, I want Laurie King, of course, and I want Michael Connelly and Lee Child and Jan Burke on the panel. And they said, well, those are our guests of honor. I said, I know, but they're not publicly identified as Sherlock Holmes fans. I happen to know that they are, and I think we can have a really stimulating panel talking about Holmes and his influence and all that with these people that are sort of unexpected. Well, of course, it was the best-attended panel at the conference, and we had great fun. And afterwards, I said to myself, wouldn't it be cool if those people wrote stories about Sherlock Holmes that came from their own points of view? And Laurie and I kicked around the idea and went to Random House, and they liked it.
Now, to be the agent provocateur here, because, of course, I'm very much in your camp, the very first thing you say in your preface is that no sooner had Conan Doyle put his pen down than thousands of pastiches began to rise up from the thickets and bushes. What made you decide to add to the number?
Well, there's never too many. In fact, they began before Conan Doyle actually laid his pen down. There were pastiches within a few years of the first one popping up.
It wasn't pastiches that we had in mind. When you look at the list of authors, these are all A-list writers. They are inundated with requests to take part in anthologies. The reason that they liked our request was because we said to them, be inspired. We're not asking you to write a Sherlock Holmes story. We're asking you to write something that comes out of your Sherlock Holmes experience. And they loved the freedom. Actually, if you look carefully at the collection, there are only one or two stories. There's only one story that's really a true Sherlockian pastiche, in that in Holmes being the central character, it fits into the published timeline and all that. There's only one story like that. That's Tom Perry's story, which is great. The others are not focused that way. I guess that's the simplest way to describe it.
I think that's a beautiful way to describe it. And one of the things that struck me is what prompted your choice of writers, other than that these are all people excellent at their craft. Was it a deliberate attempt to represent, as you seem to have here, a very wide range of writers in their genres?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we started with a handful of the people who, as Les said, were on the panel to begin with, and looked at what kind of balance we had and went out from there, so that each time we would ask a few more people, we looked at who accepted and what kind of writer we needed for completeness, though we had no clue as to what they were going to write until we started getting the stories.
How would you describe the balance you were looking for?
Well, I think we were shooting for people who wrote very closely worked crime, as opposed to looser and more, I suppose you would call them cozies. People. This sort of range between Lee Child and Alan Bradley is fairly wide, if you look at their novels.
Wow.
And people who basically are not known for writing any Sherlock Holmes stuff. What are they going to do when you start with that seed? What kind of plant will grow from it?
Did you give them any other kind of instructions other than assuring them that they did not have to do deliberate pastiches?
Not really.
Well, no, I did ask Colin Cotterill if he would like to do one that was a graphic story, because I had seen his website, which has a lot of very quirky drawings, and I thought maybe Colin would like to do something different. And so I said, if you'd like to write a graphic short story, I will see if I can bully Random House into publishing that. And he jumped at the chance. So that was, I think, the only thing that we asked anyone to do. And if he'd said no, that would have been fine as well.
That's very funny. I glanced at that one, and because of the title, I assumed that what had happened is that you had commissioned a traditional short story from him. He had failed to make your deadline and had ingeniously come up with this instead. So it was
very convincing. He was one of the first ones to turn it in, and it was that way from the beginning. So it was so exciting to be one of the editors receiving these stories sort of one at a time in the mail, sort of in a basket, and getting to open the present and read it and say, wow. I mean, some of them, you know, we guessed, for example, that if we invited Phil Margolin to write for us, that Jerry Margolin, his brother, would probably tag along, and that it would therefore bend the story in a certain direction, given Jerry's strange predilections. Jerry being the world's greatest collector of Sherlockian art, and the story being about the murder of the world's greatest collector of Sherlockian art. Certainly the stories came from the sensibilities of the writers. Neil Gaiman's story is totally unexpected, but so Neil Gaiman. Neil's a man who deeply loves Sherlock Holmes and is a man filled with fantasy in his life, and his story puts all those things together.
I love the fact that that one has two completely different voices in it, that you start out with the older Chinese man, and you think you're going to be seeing everything from his point of view, and suddenly there's that talk at the center, and the whole weight of the story shifts. It's a really beautiful piece of work.
Yes. You know, Jan Burke. Jan is very interested in the post-war period. This is a sort of a relatively new interest for her. And so it didn't surprise us to see a story that sort of went down those lines. But it was a great pleasure to get these little gifts coming to us.
It was a huge privilege, to be allowed to read them first. And Les and I would ring each other and gloat over the fact that we'd read these and nobody else in the world had seen them.
Do you feel that people were acting out or exploring things that they had thought about as readers of Holmes? Why didn't this ever happen? Why was this not explained? Oh, what if? Was it that kind of process for people, do you think?
Sure.
I think that as a writer, I can say that one of the reasons I accept commissions for doing short stories is certainly not for the money, but for the opportunity they give to play with ideas that I wouldn't be able to in a full novel. And I think that asking these writers just something inspired by the canon allowed them to follow all kinds of interesting threads in their own lives and in their own minds and in their own professional styles.
And what do you think that they might have been trying here that would have been different from their own convention? For instance, in Lee Child's, the piece reads very light until the very end, and then once again there's this terrific twist. So it's not a hard-boiled book, but it has that edge.
It's a very darkly humorous story, at least. And I think that it's something that you find in the English personality that you don't see in his novels too much.
The policeman's lot is not a happy one, Fred.
Yes.
Now, even though these are not pastiches, many people have, of course, written to some extent in the period or picked up details from the period or are clearly in some way responding to Doyle's rhythms. Laurie, you write this sort of work yourself, of course, in a very distinguished series. How do you approach getting something that feels authentic yourself?
I don't. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we worded our request the way we did. That is, inspired by, not imitating. When I write one of the Mary Russell novels, I'm writing in Russell's voice, in Russell's period, and Holmes is a supporting actor. as it happens, that lets me capture a lot of his personality in ways that a straight pastiche would not. But that's not the main goal of the thing, and it was not the main goal of these stories either. These stories were as a way of exploring, the Holmes thread in modern London, for example, the Watson wandering through with the taxi driver. There's all kinds of little elements that live in the Holmes stories that could be transplanted very beautifully, such as the BBC production has done.
I was just reading today somebody commenting they were so excited with Tony's story, the one with the taxi driver, because it became metafiction. This little work of fiction refers to this other work of fiction, namely the BBC Sherlock episode involving a taxi driver. And both of them claim to, of course, tell the truth. Well, one of the things that was interesting, too, was some of the authors in the process of writing the stories were a little bit intimidated, nervous. They'd send along the draft and basically say, please check it carefully, guys, because you guys are the experts, and I don't want to get anything wrong. And the result of that was that they did far more research than I ever anticipated they would do in doing these stories. S.J. Rosanne's piece, for example, a brilliant retelling of the story called The Man with the Twisted Lip, her story being called The Men with the Twisted Lips. I read it through carefully, and I pounced on what I thought was an error, and I went back and looked at it more carefully, and I said, no, you know, she did it exactly right. She had done so much detailed research into the original story in writing her version of the story. And so I think Laurie and I, being the editors, brought a certain fear factor to the process that led to incredibly high-quality stories.
One of the other things that was noticeable is, again, because you didn't have a deliberate collection of people replicating painstakingly a Victorian style of writing, the thing that rises to the surface is that Holmes's other gift to us is all this process, how you find out about things. And almost everybody in every story is doing something that honors that lexicon. Do you think that's one of the things that Conan Doyle gave us? Not only a character, but an amazing lexicon of criminal investigation?
I think that's one of his strengths in the stories, and I think that was one of the reasons for their popularity, was that you can build this investigation in your own mind as the characters are going through it, which has become the basis for crime fiction. If you find a fictional investigator now who doesn't keep the reader in on things, you feel very cheated.
Your question, Sarah, is one that I think interested our writers, our contributors, too. Lionel Chetwynd, for example, who is a renowned screenwriter but not known, I mean, has never written a piece of short fiction before, has told us that basically he really wanted to think out and work out whether Holmes's methods and Holmes's ideas had validity in the 21st century. And so his story doesn't mention Holmes ever, but you read those characters and you say to yourselves, oh, that's Holmes and Watson in a different setting.
And of course, that's what Dana Stabenow did in hers, too. I mean, she uses the format of a man writing something down as the case is going on, and the characters, to build this story of a kid keeping a blog. Instead of Watson writing the story, you have this young man writing blog, and as they go along and discover things, and you even have a character who is Mycroft, except he's in Alaska in the 21st century.
And I think Jacqueline Winspear's short story that had the very delightful premise of having an irritable convalescent boy pick up on all those techniques, and he simply begins to act out the way he thinks he should behave as if he were Holmes, and because he does, he arrives at an answer.
Right, and from a different point of view, so does Laura Lippman's story about a character, a 10-year-old girl, who is figuring out about secrets and about what happens when you inquire into things. And again, not very, very little in the way of nobody would recognize it as a Sherlock Holmes pastiche. A young girl named Shirley Locke Holmes, though, who nonetheless has to figure out some of the same puzzles about what happens and what are the consequences of learning secrets.
I like that one very much because in the end, of course, what she discovers is nothing to do with crime. It's to do with an aspect of her parents' relationship that she never understood before. So it's lovely to think you can take this set of values and transpose it completely to something else and still get results. Was that one of the other things you hoped for out of this?
Yes.
Yes, I think that when you're writing a short story that's about one thing, you're hoping that there is a reverberation that tells you it's about something else as well.
Now, not all of these stories, but quite a number of them do make references to stories in the canon, something as specific as The Man with the Twisted Lips and a number of others where it simply helps if you know things. However, you've chosen here a group of writers very well known in their own genres and who are popular sellers. Are you hoping to get a balance of some kind there? Do you feel that there's any danger that stories that have those references will close out people who are not Holmes readers?
I don't know that that's a problem with this collection. I think that as I find with the Russell book, if I put references to the Conan Doyle stories in there, the average reader who doesn't know the stories terribly well may read right past them. The person who does know the stories well, it's like a little shared joke. And I think that's the same way with these stories, is that if you know the Greek interpreter, you will understand what Dana Stabenow is doing on a different level. If you don't know it, it doesn't matter because it's a great story.
And you've also put in footnotes in various places to say to people, if you're interested in seeing how this was developed in the original story, here's where you go to find that out.
Yeah, we thought that was a good idea, and I'm glad Les came up with that.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't want to turn this into an annotated edition, but sort of a little tiny signpost to suggest that maybe somebody might have missed a joke. But I know that there are things there that the Sherlockians will go crazy for. The Margolin story, for example, I'm sure that they will recognize friends of theirs in the story.
Now, you are both faithful players of the game, which, for those who do not know it, is a convention in which Sherlockians pretend that the stories were written by John H. Watson and that their agent was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I see that you have very boldly, simply identified Conan Doyle as the author of these stories. It's uncommon in Sherlockian circles. Was this partly because you're operating here in a traditional publishing environment, or you just decided to be provocative?
Oh, definitely provocative. No, Random House doesn't really play the game terribly well, does it?
On the other hand, you know, did we want to mention Mary Russell, for example, who clearly is a real person because she's interviewed at the end of the book? I guess I'd describe it, Sarah, as Laurie and I are a little schizophrenic. I think the circumstances of the game or the rules of the game have changed a bit in the last 10 to 20 years. I do enjoy the game, and I typically do write things that way. But you mentioned at the top of the show the grand game, and when you look at the outstanding Sherlockian criticism of the last 100 years, not all of it plays the game. Some of it is very careful and serious scholarship relating to the relationship between Arthur Conan Doyle and these wonderful stories, and we don't want to make short shrift of that.
Yes, I think a lot of, as it were, civilians are put off by the idea that you insist that Holmes lived, that Watson wrote the stories, and so forth. It's just confusing on a certain level, and we didn't want to bother confusing people. It was not worth the price of admission.
One of the other things this really seems to do beautifully, though, is that it does celebrate that sense of perpetuity, which is one of the driving forces of Sherlockian passions, the belief that somehow or other he still lives because he couldn't die. I felt that was one of the beautiful things about the Gaiman story. It seems almost to have a poetic subtext, which is exactly that.
But just to show you our liberalism here, Sarah, we included a story in which Arthur Conan Doyle is actually the detective solving a case involving a fictional story about Sherlock Holmes.
So basically, if there was a tail to be twisted, somewhere in here it's been twisted.
We hope so.
Now, you were both very honorable editors and kept your own fingers out of your own pie. But if you were to have published one of these stories or included something yourselves, what would have attracted you as an approach?
Laura, you're the real writer. You answer that.
Well, I think that if I were to write a Sherlock Holmes pastiche, I mean, other than the one that I wrote some years ago that's inside one of the non-Russell books, I would want to look at something that happened actually to Holmes during the great hiatus when he disappears from London. I probably would actually have written the pastiche simply because I don't.
Mm-hmm. And this?
Well, I have written a pastiche in my life. I think at this point in time, if I were going to write one, it would have to be heavily footnoted.
Something you do extremely well. What do you hope readers will take away from this?
Oh, a sense of delight and perhaps an idea that by rereading the original stories, they too might be inspired.
Yes, I think that's been one of the pleasures in the Russell series is that that so many people have said, you know, I never read the Conan Doyle stories until I'd read Mary Russell, but they're actually very good.
Now, it almost feels like a passionate rearguard action itself simply to create an anthology these days. We're being told everywhere that books are going out and every form of media will eventually converge. Do you think that this is part of a way of hanging on to that sense of discovery in a book that we get from Conan Doyle? Or do you imagine that eventually Holmes could indeed leak out into all these other forms and still survive?
I think he already has.
This is out as an e-book, we are hoping at some point to have it out as an audiobook. I think that it's important to keep Holmes in print at some point, that there's something special about print, and given the history of the Sherlock Holmes stories, it's the kind of stories I'd hate to see be exclusively non-print, but Holmes is everywhere.
Thank you very much, both of you. It's a delightful book.
Thank you, Sarah.
Lovely.